This is the second lecture of the logic course. I'm announcing that to make sure I don't get confused with my other course. So, as I was saying to Danny Sanchez, if I start lecturing, say, on Calvin's theory of interest, please stop me. I'm going in the wrong course. Now, you remember, you know, where I mentioned, I think, last time my great friend, Father James Sadowski, who's now 89, he's a Jesuit, taught logic for many years at Fordham. He had a rather good comment. I was on the phone with him the other day, and he asked me, is it a logical contradiction for the same thing to be in two places at the same time? Say that I'm here in Los Angeles. Would it be a logical contradiction for me, say, to be in Auburn at the Mises Institute at the same time I'm in Los Angeles? And he contended it wouldn't be a logical contradiction. So then, an unusual view, he didn't say he thinks that it's likely to happen, but he thought there was no logical contradiction. So then, later in the conversation, I mentioned to him, I'm going to be at the Mises Institute in March for the Austrian Scholars Conference, and his immediate comment was, where else? Now, I wanted to, in today's lecture, I wanted to begin with a little bit of review. The reason I want to review this is, you remember that the last time I was explaining the base rate fallacy, I used an example from Paul Krugman, the economist. Now, there was one student who objected to this, who thought that this really wasn't a fallacy. So I wanted to go over this because it's a very important fallacy. And we can illustrate also a very important distinction. Remember that I mentioned in the last time, the distinction between truth and validity. If we're talking about validity, we mean is an argument we're considering, does it follow the rules of logic properly? If we have a conclusion, is it validly deduced from the premises? Does it go according to the rules? So validity is independent of truth. If you have true premises and you reason validly, then you're going to get a true conclusion. But whether the reasoning is valid, whether it follows the rules of logic, is a different issue from whether the premise is true. So the reason I bring this up is that the objection to what I was saying is, you'll see, let me first just go over the point that Krugman had made. I just put this on the slide so you can see it. Krugman is saying that, he's talking about the assassination attempt last year on Congresswoman Gifford, and he says, last spring there was a report, there was a surge in threats against members of Congress, which were already up by 300%. And he said, he goes on to say, there's something about the current state of America that's been causing far more disturbed people before to act out their illnesses by threatening or actually engaging in political violence. And he says the vast majority of those who listen to that toxic rhetoric stop short of actual violence, but some inevitably cross that line. So what Krugman was suggesting is, well, if we've had this increase, as he thinks there is, in violent political rhetoric, and he says, if you have enough of that, isn't that going to make somebody actually go out and commit some act of violence? So what I was contending there is that he's making a mistake here in reasoning, because what he says is that an increase in what he calls toxic rhetoric will inevitably cause some people to cross the line into violence. But what is the fallacy here? Well, it's plausible, isn't it, to think if you have increase in toxic rhetoric, this is going to increase the chances that someone will cross the line. Certainly seems reasonable to assume that. But we have to take a time. Does it follow then that we should expect somebody to actually do it? What I was contending last time is not necessarily, because if you're trying to figure out how likely something is to happen, you have to first take account of how likely was the thing in the first place. Supposing it's not very likely that people in Congress are going to be shot at, then even if you have something that increases the probability of it substantially, it wouldn't follow that it's now likely to happen. So what I was trying to illustrate, and this is the key, the most important thing you have to remember in the base rate fallacy, is this distinction between increasing the chances that something will happen and making it likely that it will happen. And I gave one example, which I'll give again because I rather like the example, I suppose, like most lectures, I'm too fond of my own examples, but supposing you buy a ticket in the lottery, it's extremely unlikely, say, in many lotteries that you're going to win. Suppose you have a 1 in 10 million chance of winning the lottery. Now, if you buy 2 tickets, you double your chances. You see, you increase the probability you'll win, but it's still extremely unlikely that you're going to win. So this is the point I wanted to illustrate, just the distinction between the increasing the chances something will happen and making it likely. Now, the objection I got, which you can see on the class discussion pages, is the objection thought, well, he thought it was pretty likely that someone would go out and shoot somebody. He thought this was a pretty good argument. And what I would say to that is, remember, what we're concerned with, and maybe I should have stressed this more the last time, I didn't do a good enough job in doing this, is not whether what Krugman is saying is correct, whether you come up with a correct conclusion, but how he gets there. So what this person suggested was, well, maybe it isn't so improbable to begin with that people in Congress would be shot, and couldn't this increase in the violent rhetoric really make it more likely than not that the incident would take place, somebody would be shot. So he's saying, well, maybe Krugman is right. Maybe it was very likely, given the climate of violence, somebody would go out and shoot a congressman. So that may well be. I don't think it is, but that doesn't matter. But all I was saying is, keep the point, remember, is it doesn't follow just from saying that this climate of violence will increase the chances that it will make it probable that it will happen. I mean, you could make the factual circumstances such that it would be probable, say, it's not so unlikely to begin with, somebody would be shot, and doing this really increases the probability a lot, so it could make it likely. But you still need to take account of this distinction. So that was all I was trying to illustrate there by this distinction. Just you should be aware of this distinction because this is extremely important. And I also mentioned, although I didn't stress this as much, this Krugman committed another fallacy, two fallacies for the price of one, is that he's first suggesting that the increase in this violent rhetoric will make it likely that someone will cross the line into violence, which I said he hasn't shown, doesn't follow from what he said, that he hasn't taken account of the probability to begin with, the base rate. And he's also assuming that the increase in rhetoric will cause someone to cross the line. So if he's saying, well, why did someone shoot Congresswoman Giffords? It's because of this increase in rhetoric. It turned out that that wasn't right. I think the person was just mentally ill and wasn't influenced by the rhetoric against Giffords. So, again, but whether that's correct or not isn't what's important for this class. It's what's important is to get this distinction between making it likely that something will happen, showing that probability will make it likely that something will happen, and saying that something is the cause of something else. Those are two different things. It's important to keep them distinct. So Krugman is really committed in two examples. The fallacy he's guilty of here, in addition to the base rate fallacy, that's the mistaken probability that he's made. He's committed an ignoratio elenchi, which is ignoring the issue in dispute. You see, what he was trying to do was say, why was Congresswoman Giffords shot? What caused her attempted assassination? And what he's answering is first, he's saying that an increase in violent rhetoric will increase the chances that someone will be violent. But that doesn't address the question of what caused her to be shot. He's changed the subject. The increase the chances doesn't imply makes probable. That was the base rate fallacy. And makes probable doesn't imply causes. So see, both of these are examples of ignoratio elenchi. I see someone has a comment here. Not going to make people's action may increase the number of times they've spoken badly about. Well, that's a very good point. But again, remember, what we're concerned here is now is not the substantive issue of what the effects of violent rhetoric is, but just the structure of the argument. We're just concerned again with validity rather than truth. Now, I want to give one other example, which I discussed last week, again, because it's very important that we get these fallacies down, is this is from a book by John Guy. And you see from the slide, he suggests first that property was originally communal, meaning owned by the community, but what he says in support of that is that suppose you say you have a right to private property, then the community has to recognize it for it to be of any value. For example, supposing, and I think he's right about that, supposing I own some property and people just occupy and I told to tell them to leave and they won't, well, unless I can get my right enforced, my right isn't going to be worth anything. But what is the fallacy here? Again, we're not disputing anything about the facts, but is that what he's originally claiming, what his thesis is that private property was originally owned by the whole community. But he's arguing for something else, which is much less controversial view, that a community must recognize private property if it is to have any value. So see, again, this is an ignoratio elenchi, just ignoring the issue in dispute. Now, I want to now deal, this is review from the last time, which I think it's very important that we get these fallacies down. And I now want to deal with the main topic today, which is the proposition or the judgment. And it's extremely important. This is one of the most important lectures, because if we're going to understand the system that Joyce has in this book, there's parts of his views on propositions that are a bit unusual or hard, not what we usually think of when we're thinking of propositions. We need to make sure we understand this if we're going to get any grasp of what he's doing in the book. There's a particular aspect of what he says that I think is a bit hard to understand. Not that it's complicated, but it just goes against the way we naturally think of things. So it's extremely important that we get what's going on here. Now the easy part is, or as he said, well, what do I mean by a proposition? Well, we have a judgment, we have a mental act, say, make a judgment, we have a subject, and we affirm or deny some attribute. Attribute is a quality of the subject. For example, suppose I say, I am funny. I'd like that to be true. It's probably false. But suppose I say, I'm funny. So I'm attributing a certain attribute, being funny, to me. So suppose we could take it. We can have all sorts of other things. That Socrates is mortal. We're attributing the attribute quality of being mortal to Socrates. So judgment, we're making a judgment, we have attribute quality, an attribute to a subject. And a proposition is the verbal expression of the judgment. It's just the judgment in words. Now, so far, that's the easy part. You're not going to, I don't think anyone would have any problems with that. It seems pretty straightforward. Judgment is just a proposition. Just you attribute or deny a certain quality to a subject, affirm or deny a certain quality to a subject. But there's a problem here that, can anyone see what the problem here is if we try to say this is kind of a general way of looking at all propositions, that proposition affirms or denies an attribute of the subject. Can anybody see what's a problem here? We have any takers on that? Well, someone says attribution errors make correct reasoning more difficult. I think that it would certainly get you into problems if you're giving the wrong attributes. But what I want to talk about now is just, is there anything wrong? Does anything appear to be wrong with saying a proposition is affirms or denies an attribute of a subject? Well, the problem, or at least the apparent problem, this is what we have to do when I'm saying this is the part that's counterintuitive but hard to understand. It appears, at least on the surface, that many propositions don't have that form. Suppose I say, I'm lecturing now. Well, what we have here is we have a subject, all right, namely I, but then we have a verb, lecturing. Lecturing isn't an attribute. Attributes are adjectives, but lecturing is a verb. There are many propositions, many sentences that don't have this form of subject attribute. So what are we going to do about that? And what we have to do, and this is the part that where we get into the stuff that's a bit hard to understand, we have to change all propositions so that they are of a subject attribute form. And this is so if we have a proposition that doesn't look like it's in the subject attribute form, we somehow have to shoehorn it in so it does have this form. So then why do we want to do that? Because this is the way Joyce's system of logic works, that all propositions are subject and attribute. Now, here we have an additional complication, because when he says, first we have to get all the propositions so they're in subject attribute form, but he takes this subject attribute form in an unusual way. Again, let's take the proposition Socrates is mortal. Well, what we would say in ordinary language, and probably in your taken grammar in your English class, you would get this, is that Socrates is, the subject is a noun, and then you have the attribute mortal, and you're predicating the attribute mortal of Socrates. So you have, so when you say Socrates is mortal, the is there is what's called an is a predication. Okay, so this is kind of the way we take in ordinary language. You have a subject, then the predicate, and you have the is, which is called the copula, because it's joining the subject and predicate. Is a predication. Now that's not the way you take it in scholastic logic, at least the kind of scholastic logic that Joyce is talking about in this book. Here, both Socrates and mortal are names of the same entity. Now what do we mean by a name? Well, a name is just a word or term that you can use to refer to something, like say why we have names, like why each of us is named something, well, so people can refer to us. So this makes sense for Socrates, but it seems odd, doesn't it, to say that mortal is a name. I mean, you could imagine some parents who have an odd sense of humor who name their child mortal. Mortal in ordinary language doesn't sound like a name. It sounds like it's an adjective. So what's going on here? Well, the way Joyce is taking it is, again, mortal is a name because it's really a way of picking out Socrates. Just as if you take the name Socrates, Socrates in quotation marks, refers to the person Socrates. You can use that name to pick him out. You can take mortal, where you're taking it as kind of mortal man, also to pick out Socrates. So you would take it not as an adjective, but as part of a noun phrase. So say mortal is another name for Socrates. It's not a proper name, meaning a name, remember we talked about that last week, meaning proper name is one that doesn't have any content. It's just purely referential. You couldn't tell anything about Socrates, what his characteristics were, just from knowing he has the name Socrates. But mortal is also, in this scholastic logic, another way of naming Socrates, because it's short for mortal man, and that's a way you can pick out Socrates. So Every proposition in classic logic, both subject and predicate name the same thing. Something's going on in the chat room. I'll get to that later. Okay, so both the subject and predicate are naming the same thing. This is true not only. Remember, proposition can be one where it either affirms or denies this. So suppose you have a proposition denying an attribute, Southeast Asia, no man is immortal. You're denying, you're again both terms are referring to the same thing. You're again referring to how would you do that? You're referring to the class of immortals, things that are immortal, and you're referring to that class again by saying that men are excluded from that class. So men men are, by being excluded from the class, it's a way of referring to the immortals. You're saying the immortals don't include any men in them. So again, in every proposition, the subject and predicate are naming the same thing. So what we have here is, remember I was talking about is a predication. It isn't an is a predication in scholastic logic, it is of identity. So every proposition is really an identity. There are two names for the same thing. This is much clearer in affirmative propositions than negative propositions, but you can get it in negative propositions too if you're clever enough to do that. Now, Joyce also says, supposing it's impossible to combine a particular predicate with a subject. It gives the example, all dogs are reptiles. Well, not the ones that we know at any rate. So it's impossible that a dog be a reptile. So I said, well, this isn't a legitimate proposition. So as I mentioned before, the is always an is of identity, not an is of predication. So what we have in the proposition, the subject term is referring to something, and the predicate term is referring to that same thing. So we're really, every proposition is really an identity. Now, this is one of the main areas where scholastic logic differs from mathematical logic. Remember, I mentioned last time, if you go to a university class in logic, what you almost always be getting is mathematical logic. And one of the reasons that mathematical logician criticized scholastic logic was they said, and I have in mind here a particularly great 20th century logician, Gottlob Frege, and his slightly later contemporary British philosopher, Bertrand Russell. They said, look, the subject predicate logic that's used in scholastic logic really can't handle a lot of propositions. For example, suppose I say A is to the right of B. That's a state of relation. It has three places in it. One term is to the right of another term. Two-place relation. We could have something we have other ones. I am older than my son, but younger than my father. So we have another relational. But they said, Reagan Russell said, look, if you have subject and predicate, just subject and predicate, you can't handle relation. Now, is this right? Well, it's certainly cumbersome to handle relations and subject-predicate logic. But as I was saying before, you can find a way, really, of jamming all the propositions in, even have relations or other more complicated propositions, you can really get it into the subject-predicate form. Now, you might say, well, why should you want to do that? Why not take this as a relation separately? Why we have to get it in this seemingly unnatural form? And again, say if you have a proposition where you have a subject and verb, why can't you leave it at that? Why do you have to always get it in this form where you have an is of identity? Isn't this somewhat unnatural? And if that's right, it is, but remember, this is the way that this system works. If you use mathematical logic, you won't have those problems, but you'll find there are other complications that you'll have with mathematical logic. You'll find sometimes it's very tricky to translate ordinary English sentences into the proper form, symbolic form, and you'll find various various difficulties in you'll find mathematical logic. So really, each of the systems of scholastic and mathematical logic have advantages and disadvantages. And what we've gone over now, and this is why I've gone over it at some length, is that this is a difficulty in scholastic logic. It's very important that you understand this because it's a rather unnatural way of looking at certain propositions. You're not likely to take all propositions as identities of subject and predicate. So, as an example, here suppose we have the proposition, Hitler invades Russia. So we have to change this to Hitler is invading Russia. What would mean that Hitler is naming a particular person, namely Hitler, and invading Russia is also a name would be the person who is invading Russia. So we would have, again, an identity. You know, I use an example because I can give one of my funny stories. There was a songwriter and a composer who was also very humorous, probably before your time, named Oscar Levant. And he once commented, he said, we can say Hitler invaded Russia or Germany invaded Russia, but we can't say Hitler invaded Stalin or Germany or Hitler or Germany invaded Stalin. He said that wouldn't be proper English. So I just thought I'd throw that in. Well, I thought it was funny anyway, but that won't be on the quiz. Okay. So another thing that's important to remember is when I talk about the copula is this indicates existence or being of a subject, but it doesn't have to be existence in reality. We can be talking about just ideas that people have in the mind. For example, suppose I say Hamlet was indecisive. That's a true proposition, because if you talk about Shakespeare's play, Hamlet was indecisive, but Hamlet wasn't a real person, it was just an idea in Shakespeare's mind. But we can still have that proposition, Hamlet was indecisive, because the is doesn't have to be existence in reality. And one thing I should say before, it also that I didn't put on slide, but when I said, let's take the proposition again, Hamlet was indecisive. When we're getting this in the proper logical form, so we can do all the correct operations with the system, with Joyce's system, we have to get everything wouldn't be really a good proposition. It would be, is Hamlet is indecisive. Now that should be taken not as meaning in the present tense, like is indecisive as opposed to was indecisive, kind of a timeless is. So what we do, we take all the tenses like past, present, and future, and we can convert them into a timeless statement. Suppose we say, Hitler invaded Russia. He's not invading Russia now. Fortunately, he's long since dead. We can get that. We would just say Hitler is invading Russia in 1941. So we convert any sentence in the that has tenses, past, present, or future, we can convert it into a timeless sentence just by giving it a certain date. The great American logician William Quine called these eternal sentences. So we can, but that's one thing we want to do. So again, thing to remember is propositions in scholastic logic have to be changed around in a somewhat unnatural way to get them into the proper form for reasoning. Now, I now want to go over something that I think is another thing that's extremely important. This, you know, if you go through Joyce's book, you'll see he gives all sorts of technical terms. He has words for everything, somewhat confusing. And most of those I don't ask you to remember. I'm sure I don't remember most of them myself, but this particular thing I would like everyone to learn because, again, it's extremely important. It's a way of classifying all propositions. You know, we have, they're using these following A, I, E, and O. Now, an A proposition is a universal affirmative. That says that it asserts something of every member of a certain class. Let's take the old standby, all men are mortal. What that's saying is that every member of the class is mortal. So it's affirming something of every member of the class. So that's what I call a universal affirmative or an A proposition. And one thing that's a bit tricky here, as Joyce points it out, suppose I said all the men together could lift the weight. That wouldn't be a universal affirmative because that would just be saying that that would be true of everyone taken together, but it wouldn't, you wouldn't be affirming that each of the men in this group could lift the weight. So a universal affirmative is saying that every member of a class has a certain property. So that's not all the members of the class taken together can do something, every member of the class separately can do it. Now, a particular affirmative is saying that some, at least one member of the class can, an attribute of at least one member of the class. So when you say some men are mortal, that would be saying at least one man is mortal. So see the difference between universal affirmative and particular affirmative. Universal affirmative says every member of the class has a certain attribute. Particular affirmative says at least some members of the class have an attribute, have the attribute. Now, one thing that's different in scholastic logic from ordinary language, and this is one that's very important to note because people miss this. I found last year when I gave the I taught this course last year, I found there were people who missed this on the quizzes. Suppose we take let's take the particular affirmative, which is called an I proposition. So A is universal affirmative. I is particular affirmative. Let's take some men are mortal. Now, does it follow from that that some men, if you say some men are mortal, does this imply some men are mortal? And the answer is no, that sometimes in ordinary language, suppose I say some people will be voting Republican in the next election. I ordinarily wouldn't say that if I thought all people are going to vote Republican in the next election. But in logic, that isn't the way we look at things. Some is perfectly consistent with all. And in fact, if you take the universal proposition, let's say, again, all men are mortal, in scholastic logic, not only is this consistent with some men are mortal, but it implies it. If all men are mortal, some men are mortal, because all men are mortal, saying every member of the class is mortal. Some men are mortal, saying at least one member of the class is mortal. So the A proposition implies the I proposition. Of course, it doesn't work the other way around, because they, suppose I say, some people are overweight. It doesn't follow that all people are overweight. But if you say all people are overweight, then it does follow that some people are overweight. Now, one thing to kind of interesting here, we don't have to remember this, but it's interesting. In mathematical logic, it doesn't work that way. Universal affirmative, all men are mortal, doesn't imply that some men are mortal. And the reason for that is, in mathematical logic, all men are mortal isn't taken to imply the existence of any men. It's just saying, if there are any men, then those men are mortal. But some men are mortal is taken to imply that at least one man exists. So in mathematical logic, A doesn't imply an I, but in scholastic logic, what we're doing, it does. Now, universal negative, which is called an E proposition, is one where we deny a property and attribute of a whole class. Suppose I say, no Austrian economist is a socialist. What I'd be saying there is that the class of Austrian economists is totally excluded from the class of socialists. So I'd be just saying these groups have nothing to do with each other. You can imagine, say, two circles that are just not connected at all. So you can say, in the universal negative, is saying denying an attribute or quality of every member of the subject class. And an O proposition is a particular negative. It's saying, well, I say, some Austrian economists are not socialists. So that would be saying at least one Austrian economist isn't a socialist. So just like in the relation between A and I, if the E proposition is true, if I say no Austrian economist is a socialist, then it follows that some Austrian economist is not a socialist. But it doesn't work the other way around, because, say, if I say some Austrian economist is not a socialist, it doesn't follow that none of them are. I mean, it could be that some Austrian economists are socialist, but some aren't. But again, remember, again, some is consistent with all. So it's not like, this is a bit confusing, because in ordinary language sometimes, when we say some, we mean some but not all. that isn't the way it's used in scholastic logic. So just remember this A, I, E, and O. This is a very important table to learn. Now, some propositions are hard, but fortunately not impossible to classify. And Joyce goes into very elaborate detail on this. I don't think we need to go into that here, but let's give a few examples. Suppose we have a singular proposition. Suppose I say Socrates is mortal. I'm sure if you take any logic class, you probably heard that one. Well, how would you classify this in this table, this AIO? There's just one Socrates. So the way most it's usually classified is if Socrates were a class of one. So it would be taken as a universal affirmative because saying all the Socrates that there is, namely that one of him, is mortal. So a singular proposition is taken as a universal proposition. Now, a complex proposition is not really that complex. It's just one that refers to a particular term by some kind of limiting description. Well, I say the first lecture on the program was boring. Well, then I'm referring to the term lecture on the program. I have lecture, and then I'm modifying it by saying lecture on the program, saying the first one of those. So again, this doesn't really present very many problems. You just have to make sure you understand what the term is. You're using a description to pick out the term instead of just a single name or separate attribute. It really doesn't change anything. And similarly, a compound proposition is really two or more propositions in one. I suppose I say none but the brave are free. So I'm really combining here, I'm suggesting I have a proposition, no one who is not brave is free. That would be one of the propositions. And then it would probably be understood as me, the brave are free. So if I say none but the brave are free, I'm saying the brave are free and no one who isn't brave is free. So I'm combining here, none but the brave are free would combine an A proposition, the brave are free, with an E, no one who is not brave is free. So that would be an example of a compound proposition. Now, one thing I want to go into, another topic I want to go into here, because I think this is an extreme, a very philosophically interesting part of Joyce's chapter, in fact, the entire book. He has a section on analytic and synthetic propositions. You probably, those of you who are familiar with Austrian economics, will know there's all sorts of people, Mises says, in Austrian economics is a priori science. I won't get into what that means. And he talks about synthetic a priori propositions and then various people attacking things. There's no such thing as synthetic a priori proposition. So you get into a lot of trouble here. And I think if you look at this section by Joyce, he gives a very interesting approach that I think can be very useful for those of us who are interested in understanding Austrian economics. I think you could use what Joyce is saying here about analytic and synthetic proposition to help us understand what the Mises and Rothbard are saying. Now, the way Joyce talked about analytic propositions. He said, in an analytic proposition, the predicate is contained in the intention of the subject. Now, intention is something like meaning. Notice, it's not intention with a T. Intention with a T means something like what you want to do, like I'm doing this intentionally, I'm doing it on purpose. Intention with an S means the meaning of something. So either the predicate is contained in the intention of the subject, or the subject in the intention of the meaning. So he's saying either the predicate is part of the meaning of the subject, or the subject is part of the meaning of the predicate. So a simpler way to understand it is that in an analytic proposition, the predicate is part of the concept of the subject, or it follows from the concept of the subject. Suppose we say all bachelors are male. Bachelor is a male of a certain age who isn't married. So the predicate male, that's M-A-L-E, not M-I-A-L, the predicate male is part of the concept of subject. The subject, bachelor, is an unmarried male of a certain age. So that has male in it. So that's what makes it analytic in that way. So but what Joyce's contribution here is with its scholastic thing, you could have another kind of analytic proposition where the subject is part of the predicate. Suppose we say all men are mortal. So here, mortal would have as part of its meaning entities that don't live forever, including men. So men would be part of the meaning of the predicate. So as Joyce points out, this is different from what Immanuel Kant thought. Immanuel Kant only recognized the first of these kinds of propositions analytic. So for Kant, all bachelors are male would be analytic. But suppose I say, what would be the example? It's true of all triangles, right triangles, that the hypotenuse is equal to a certain formula. I forget what it was because that was elementary geometry. I haven't taken that for 50 years. But suppose you say, you just give the Pythagorean theorem. So say, well, that isn't part of the definition of right triangle. The Pythagorean theorem is true of it. But nevertheless, the proposition is necessarily true. So what Joyce said, well, we could understand this in saying that the predicate, things which the Pythagorean theorem are true, would include triangles. So I think this is an interesting way we could apply this in Austrian economics. Suppose you say something like, in Austrian economics, say someone always chooses his most highly valued alternative. Well, how do you know this is necessary? What is the logical status of that? Well, it doesn't appear to be analytic in the usual way we take it, but the Kantian way, because it's not part of the definition of choice that you choose your most highly valued alternative. So Mises said, well, it's not analytic. Then some people might say, well, maybe it's synthetic. But one way you can get around that is say, no, the part of the meaning of highest value and alternative is what the person would choose. So the subject there is part of the predicate, part of the meaning of the predicate. So it's analytic in this other way. And of course, where once Kant came in with this restricted view of analytic, where he said only definitions count as analytic, not necessary propositions where the subject term is part of the predicate. Then the next step was the logic positive that all analytic propositions are conventional, they're just ones that we arbitrarily decide on, so we can't really attain truth that way. I think if you look at things from this point that Joyce is giving, you can see kind of a way of understanding what's going on in Austrian economics. I think that's for those of you who are interested in that topic. And a synthetic proposition, by the way, is one where there isn't a conceptual connection between the subject and predicate. So the predicate isn't part of the meaning of the subject, and the subject isn't part of the meaning of the predicate. So that's a synthetic one. Now, another topic that Joyce covers is also very important, is what he calls modal propositions. Suppose I say Socrates is mortal. Well, that's just a statement of what is true, something true in the world as the actual world, the world as we find it. Socrates is mortal. But suppose I say necessarily Socrates is mortal. That means it's not possible that Socrates not be mortal. It must be the case that Socrates is mortal. And again, we could have something that's impossible, as I say, no circle is a square. Nothing can be both a circle and a square at the same time. It's impossible that something be both. So we have this we call a modal proposition that's talked about necessity of possibility. And suppose I say, it's possible that Ron Paul will be the next president. And I'm saying it's not logically excluded that he'd become the next president. There'd be nothing impossible about the conjunction of Ron Paul and the next president. But if I say it's possible that, so that's a very limited claim. I'm just saying there's no logical contradiction there. It's not impossible. Now, sometimes in ordinary language, if you say something is possible, you mean it's not actually true. So I say, well, it's possible the rain tomorrow. That would be a perfectly natural thing to say. But suppose it's raining now, and I say it's possible it's raining now when it is raining now. That would be a very unusual thing to say in ordinary language. I would just say it's possible if it's not really the case, but that isn't the way it's used in logic. In logic, if you say something is possible, that's consistently saying it's actually true. Also, it's saying that it's necessarily true. So I say necessarily Socrates is mortal, that it follows that possibly Socrates is mortal. And in fact, logicians today really developed this modal logic into a whole separate area. We can take courses in modal logic. It's one of the sub-specialties of logic. It's been developed much further than when the scholastics wrote, although some of the scholastics knew a great deal about modal logic themselves. A hypothetical proposition, that's a very easy one to understand, is something like, instead of saying Socrates is mortal, it's an if proposition. If Socrates is a man, then he's mortal. Something holds on condition of something else. And a disjunctive proposition is one where we say, or either I'm lecturing now, or I'm fast asleep. So we say one or the other is true. So that's a disjunctive proposition. In contemporary logic, when we say or, it's usually understood to mean one or the other or both, but it isn't always taken that way. Joyce has some discussion whether you want to take or in a disjunctive proposition to be exclusive, meaning one or the other and not both, or inclusive, meaning one or the other and or both. So there are two different words for that in Latin, but you can distinguish the two. But we're not going to get into that much. Now, I'm a little over time, but I want to get into a couple more fallacies. These will be pretty easy to understand. One, I give a quotation from a book by two philosophers, one of whom, Thomas Nagel, is one of the absolute top philosophers in the world, but he makes, I guess, a fallacious inference here. He says, if there's a dominant theme that runs through our discussion, it's this. Private property is a legal convention defined in part by the tax system. And he goes on to say, the conventional nature of property rights is both perfectly obvious and remarkably easy to forget. We cannot start by taking as given some initial allocation of possessions, what people own, what is theirs, prior to government interference. So what Nagel was saying, then we're not concerned with whether it's what he's saying is true or not. We're just concerned with how he's arguing. He's saying it's not the case to say some libertarians believe that people have natural rights to property, can acquire property independently of what the government recognizes. Property is just whatever the legal system assigns to people, so property is purely conventional. So what the problem I have here is, he says, private property is a legal convention defined in part by the tax system. Therefore, the tax system cannot be evaluated by looking at the impact on private property, conceived of something as independent of system's validity. So what, it should be Murphy and Nagel, not Murphy and Murphy. Murphy and Nagel are begging the question because they say property rights are conventional, so there are no such thing as natural rights to property. And what is the reason for this It's because property rights are conventional. So they're just really using the same, they're concluding something by giving the same premise where they say property rights are conventional, therefore property rights are conventional. Now that's certainly a valid inference. If property rights are conventional, then property rights are conventional. But it isn't a good argument because unless you already accepted that property rights are conventional, you're not going to be convinced by it. So what they're doing is what's called begging the question. They're just assuming a controversial theory and rather than arguing for it. So this is a very simple fallacy, but people commit it all the time. They'll say something follows, but they haven't really argued for it. They just asserted it or just derived it from something which is really the same claim. Now, just one point of usage here is that beg the question does not mean raise the question. It's just a point of grammar. Usage. You'll find people saying, I hear this on television all the time, well, this really begs the question of something, but it just raises the question. That's really very bad English. You shouldn't say that. Please don't do that. Although I know this is an English class, but I couldn't resist pointing that out. Now, here I just give another example of fallacy. This is from The Economist. Jeff Madrick, he says, because in fact these high tax economies actually do well, it follows that what happened in the real world is that much of our tax money is spent constructively. So he's saying, this is what the famous post hoc ergo propter hoc tells us, after this, therefore because of it. So what he's saying is, if the government imposes high taxes and the economy then did well, so he's thinking, well, then it follows that the high taxes are being spent in a way that's helping the economy. But that doesn't follow at all. I mean, it might be true. I don't think it is true, but it might be true that the high taxes are causing the economy to do well. But it doesn't follow just because you have high taxes and the economy is doing well, that the high taxes are causing the economy to do well. Could be that the high taxes are actually impeding the economy from doing well. Maybe it would do even better without the high tax. So this is the other fallacy, very important, called the post hoc fallacy. We say after this, therefore, because of this. Now, I'll just give a couple others. This is one that from the judge and legal theorist economist, Richard Posner, he said, suppose there were 100% probability that unless preventive terrorists were known to be loose in Manhattan would explode a nuclear bomb. No sane person would balk at abandonment of the conventional limitation of the power to search and see, and the power to extract information from suspects and even bystanders. So then he said, well, I'm not concerned now with whether he's right. He said, suppose it was absolutely new, somebody had some nuclear bomb, couldn't you do various awful things to him to get the information on where the bomb is? Again, I'm not concerned now whether that's true or not. But then he says, well, then if you say that, what are the probabilities? 99%, couldn't you still do these bad things to him? So what he wants to say is we have to come up with some kind of balancing of how much probability of a danger we would have in what we'd want to do to the person. He said, well, you can't say that he's absolute profit bans on things, because wouldn't it just be a matter of balancing? As long as you say there's 100% probability, then you don't have to say, well, 99% probability is all right, and maybe 98. So you couldn't have any really fixed rules about it. It'd just be all a matter of balancing. So this is a misuse of what's called the Sorites paradox. This is a Greek word meaning a heap. Now let's say you start with a completely bald man, and then you add one hair to this person. The person has no hair on it, and you add one hair. Well, isn't the person still bald? Well, okay, so they say fine, but then adding one hair can't change whether somebody is bald. So say if you have imagine have a bald person, somebody isn't bald, it wouldn't be that just one has one hair more than the other. So then we would get, well, you could get the conclusion someone with a full head of hair is bald, because you could just keep adding, start with a bald person, you could just keep adding one hair after the other. Adding the hair doesn't change whether they're bald. And so you get that the person with a full head of hair is bald. Of course, what's gone wrong here is that even if we can't say exactly where the distinction between what's bald and what isn't bald is, it doesn't mean there's no distinction at all. And so this is where opposers misuse this argument. You say, well, if you say 100%, you could use these unusual methods to get information, then why not 99%? Then 99%, why not 98%? Then you can't really have any fixed rule, but that doesn't follow any more than the fact that we can't say exactly where certain boundaries lie in bald and not bald would mean that there's no distinction between the two. So this is the Sorites paradox. And then the last thing I want to give is another, it's been attacking Posner, I like to attack him, is another example, ignoratio elenchi. Remember, that's changing the subject. So he's responding to an objection to judicial review. Judicial review is that the judges get to decide on whether laws are constitutional. Some people say, well, judges abuse this because they impose their values on the rest of us. So what he replies to this is, well, there are problems with democracy too. Democracy, say sometimes people will enforce their own values on minorities. Aren't there a lot of problems with democracy? And I think he's right. There are a lot of problems with democracy, but he isn't responding to the objection, which is that elitist judges can impose their bounds on the rest of us. So he's not answering. But, well, I got a bit over, so, but I did want to go over a few more of these fallacies. So I think in the time remaining, if we have more, too many questions, we can go over overtime if you want, but we can, that will have, I'm now going to the Q&A box, so please type your questions in there and I'll try to deal with them or evade them. Now wait, let me see here. Emily says all A is B is universal affirming. That's right. Alan asked a good one. How about a man is mortal? Well, here, this would be an A proposition because a man sounds like it's just picking out one particular man. But here, A is being used to mean the whole class. Like it would be another way of saying it, man is mortal. I could be saying a man is mortal. Or you say something like a dog has four legs. You wouldn't mean this particular dog has four legs. You mean it's true of dog. Now, Emily says all A is B equals universal affirming. All A in a group is B is particular affirmative. What about all modified A is B? Is that a universal or particular affirmative? Example, all blue A is B. Does blue A constitute a group that can be used universal? But yes, that's a very good question. That's what George calls a complex proposition. You're just picking out a particular, you're just using a particular limit to constitute a group. But what makes it affirmative is you're talking about, when you say all blue A, you mean each case of a blue A is B. So that what making it universal. So in other words, it's a complex proposition. Universal. Well, I mean, yeah, it just depends on what the complex proposition is. It just depends on the complex proposition's way of referring to a particular term. So then you just have to see what the rest of the proposition is. Now, Karen says, can we say either I am lecturing now or I am not? Would that be disjunctive? Yes. Yes, it would be, because either I'm lecturing now or I'm not. So one is, well, that's in a later lecture, we'll be discussing that, the law of excluded middle, and that would always be true. Propositions that have that form are always true. So it would be disjunctive. Now, Chris says, can you discuss Mises' synthetic a priori reasoning theory for human action? Well, I mean, there's some, it's a bit off the subject of the course, I won't say much about it, but what, at least, Mises sometimes says, in human action, he doesn't really say that the proposition is synthetic, but some people on top of take it to be that way. But in other words, a priori means something like, it's fairly similar, although not exactly the same as what we talked about, necessarily true, like we say, it's just conceptually true. Like before I say, all men are mortal, I'm saying it's part, let's take a better example. Let's suppose I say, all bachelors are male, I'm saying it's part of the concept of bachelor that it's, that bachelors are male. So that's a priori because it's part of the concept. Now, that's what's called an analytic proposition, because it's part of the concept of the subject of the bachelor that it's male. all bachelors are male. Now, in since the way Kant defined analytic proposition, that's what an analytic proposition is. It must be one where the predicate is part of the subject. So male is part of bachelor. So it's part of the definition, so that makes it analytic. So then let me use one to say, well, there's some propositions that aren't analytic in that way. At least some people want to take these and say there's some propositions that aren't analytic in that way, but they're still necessarily true. So how can that be? So then some people say, well, then there's a special class of synthetic a priori propositions. But I would suggest one way you could get around that is to take analytic in this extended way Joyce gives it, where you could have not only the predicate is part of subject, but the subject is part of the predicate, would also count as analytic. Now, David says, theme logic spent about half of the time discussing scholastic logic in simple propositions, half dealing with complicated discourse and complicated propositions. How are the two topics related? Will scholastic logic help? Well, what I'm trying to do with these more complicated ones is just show examples of logical fallacies. And where the scholastic logic will come in is, we'll see, you know, this requires more lectures, we'll see later on how you can get arguments. You've so heard, we've just talked, first lecture we talked about concepts, remember now we talked about judgment, then we'll be talking later lectures about syllogisms, which are actual arguments. So the way they're related is, if you get, say you take these complicated ones and get them into the proper form, like you get them into the system that Joyce gives, you'd be able to see very easily whether they are logically valid, whether they're committing fallacy. So what I'm trying to do now is I'm saying, well, even before you do that, you can just take sort of more complicated proposition without going through the analysis. You can just see by looking at them, by knowing some of these fallacies, what's wrong with them. So I'm trying to give you some fallacies. And so, as I say, one thing I want to give you, so what I'm trying to do is both, I'm trying to give you a formal system, namely the one that Joyce has given, and sort of show informally how just when you read things, you can be on the alert for certain kinds of fallacies, but maybe they can, I could try to connect them better with different suggestions and make a good comment. Karen says, man is more clear by naming the same thing that we refer to a dominant attribute of the subject. Well, I think that's right. Remember, a proposition doesn't have to be given important attribute. It's any attribute that picking that is true of something enables you to pick it out. Or one, if you have a negative proposition, be one excluding it from the subject. So any, remember, in a proposition scholastic logic, it's one of two names for the same thing. So any proposition has that form. I think there are some modern logicians like Peter Geech, who's a very famous logician, really will get extremely angry when anyone mentions the two name theory of logic. He hates the two name theory, but it's the one that the system uses. Joanna says, can the premise of an argument be accepted by both parties, follow the rules of logic by both parties, and come to different conclusions? Well, as you worded that, no, because they accept the premises and then they apply the rules of logic correctly, they're going to come up with the same result. Now, there is a way of understanding what you're saying where that would make sense, because what you would have there is you could say something, well, they accept the premises, and then they see what follows from them, But let's say one of them just doesn't like the conclusion. And say, oh, well, if this is where these premises are leading, I don't accept this conclusion, so I'm going to reject one of the premises. So they could come up with different conclusions in the sense of different results. But one would say, okay, I take these premises, here's what these premises imply, and I'm going to take the conclusion, accept the conclusion. If somebody could say, well, here's the premise, here's the conclusion, I can't accept the conclusion, so I'm not going to accept the premises. What they couldn't do is accept the premises reason in the same way validly, come to the same thing, come to different results. They could modify their acceptance of premises and end up differently that way. That they would, if they start with the same premises and reason validly, then they'll get the same conclusions in that way. You see, differently. You could just change around, and just change your mind about accepting the premise when you see where it's leading. Let's see if anyone has anything in the chat also. I see some discussion. Oh, let's see if anyone else. Joanna has another question. Is an argument ad hominem, could it be a logical argument? Well, there are different ways of understanding an ad hominem. I mean, you could have an ad hominem that doesn't violate any rules of logic, but can it be a logical argument? Well, I mean, you could have something that doesn't contain any fallacy of reason, but what's wrong with an ad hominem, an attack on the person of another person, of the one who's giving an argument. I mean, supposing, let's say you're reading an argument by Mises where he says minimum wage laws won't attain the goals that the people who favor those want. People favor minimum wage laws, want to help the poor, but minimum wage laws will cause unemployment, so that's not going to help the ones it's intended to help. So suppose somebody said in response that, well, you know, Mises was an employee of the Austrian Chamber of Commerce, so he's just saying that because he's interested in promoting what's best for business. So see, if you said Mises was an employee of the Austrian Chamber of Commerce, you wouldn't be committing any fallacy in reasoning. But what you're doing is not responding to what Mises said, but you have an argument about why minimum wage laws don't work. But you're just attacking him. You're saying, well, this argument is no good because of Mises had these interested motives for advancing the argument. So you're not responding to the argument. So that what is what's called an argument, as you mentioned, ad hominem, attacking the person. Okay, still some time left. Okay, we have some more question. Oh, here's one. Not to monopolize the Q&A, but would you say the argument ad hominem has weak premises? Well, I mean, it doesn't really have a premise. I mean, you could have an ad hominem argument with a conclusion of certain, but what's wrong with the ad hominem is it's not really responding to what's being considered. It's just an attack on a person. So it's really, what's wrong with the ad hominem is it's really not relevant. It's a bit similar, remember I was talking about in Rashi or Lenki where you change the subject. This is kind of a particular way of changing the subject. So you see what the problem is here. You're not addressing the argument, just saying, well, here's something bad about this person. Now, Virgilio said, any thoughts on the map is not the territory. Well, that was a famous statement by Count Korzybski. Now, actually, Roderick Long has written on this. The thought that the map is not the territory, saying when you're abstracting, you're really distorting things because you're not considering everything. Say, you're looking at a map, it doesn't have all the features of the territory it's mapping. But Roderick points, Long points, I think very effectively, it doesn't follow from that the map isn't completely accurate because you need not be saying that's all there is to the territory. You're just considering certain features from it. So I think it's true the map is not the territory. It doesn't imply that all maps are distorted. Now, David says, Alfred North White at British Mathematician coined the fallacy of misplaced concreteness in the early 20th century. Do you know any fallacies discovered more recently? Are some types that are new related to change in technology? Perhaps? Well, I think there are. Fallacy of misplaced concreteness isn't a fallacy of reasoning. That's an example of what Whitehead considered a philosophical mistake, where you're taking something that isn't, you're taking sort of an abstraction, like a particle moving in space, if they consider it physics, and treating that as if it were a really existing entity. But that's just, he thinks if people do that, they're not making a mistake in logic. They're just making what he considers, they're just adopting what he considers a wrong philosophical theory. So it isn't strictly misplaced concreteness, it isn't strictly a fallacy in logic. Now, on the if there are logical fallacies discovered more recently, I think most of them have been pretty standard for a long time. I think people have discovered there's some in modal logic, there's some examples where people have come up with new things. They're very tricky propositions in modal logic that fortunately we won't be getting into in this course. I think people have discovered new fallacies, but most of the fallacies have been known for a long time. The ones I'll be talking about in class are ones that are pretty well known, for a long time. Oh, well, thank you, Joanna. Thank you for coming. Well, we have time for anyone. If anyone has some extra questions, we still have some time. Oh, someone says Lecture 3 is not available on the web page. Wait a sec.
Extra payment.
Oh, that would, I think it is, that would, that was going to present some problems. If it, oh yeah, Joyce. Oh, oh, we got to hit, well, oh, we have one, okay, it's impossible to combine a predicate with a subject. Could you elaborate a little more, please? Well, that would be one, what would I say, a circle is not a square. It's one where, it's not one where it just happens to be the case that circles aren't squared, but it's impossible that a circle be a square because of the way the two terms are defined. Nothing could be both. So, what this is just referring to is that there are some attributes that just don't go with certain subjects. So, any proposition that said, say, all circles or squares, it just, you wouldn't have to investigate whether it's true or false. It would just not be possible that it be true. Now, Chris said, what percentage of logicians accept the two main theories? Well, I think there are probably not that many today. There's one Fred Summers, S-O-M-M-E-R-S, who is has a formal logic kind of similar to scholastic logic, and his students, such as George Engbrett, and the two names there, Irving Kopai, who is a kind of a mathematical logician, is also accused by Geach of being a two name theory. So I'd say probably not the majority. I don't know anyone's done a survey, but most, probably more logicians accept this view of Frege, remember I mentioned him before, there's a basic distinction between subject and predicate, that you can't really take them as two names. But in this system, that's the way you do it, and you can work things around so that things work as things. You know, you can classify all the propositions so it works out. Now, Virgilio says, what concept of truth is managed in logic? Would that be the same one used in hard sense? Well, by truth, it means just in a common sense way, just saying whatever is the case that something is true if what it asserts is actually the case, like you say. All men are morally true just in case all men are mortal. Just a very common sense way of truth. I think it would be one used in the hard sciences, but not confined to the truth of justice. Regular term in ordinary language. Okay, well, I guess that's about it. So thanks very much. Hope we'll see you for the next lecture. And thanks very much for coming. Okay, bye everybody. Thank you.